Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Darren DeWalt of the UNC Division of Internal Medicine about health literacy and doctor-patient communication, something that is very important to us.
It is, although I'm not so sure that those terms, health literacy and doctor-patient communication, they're not intuitive terms. I know we're going to talk with Dr. DeWalt about how we understand what it is they do, but and that will be really important.
It will. But first, we've got some research that matters. It's also important.
We do, Christy. And, you know, I'm so excited about this first one because it's really about prostate cancer surgery. And we're going to be talking about prostate cancer, I think, surgery and the treatment of that disease more because there's a lot happening. This was a really interesting article that looks at, you know, is it important to get in and get your surgery right after you get a diagnosis or not?
And this was a study done by some Swedish researchers looking at about 2,500 men who had cancer confined to the prostate gland and followed them to see if having surgery early versus waiting a year and doing something called active surveillance has any difference in outcomes.
Yeah, and this was in the Journal of Urology, and there's increasing, really, I guess, skepticism at some level that we've diagnosed so much prostate cancer with the PSA test, but so many of those were early ones that may not have even become really symptomatic in people's lifetime. So beginning to sort through which prostate cancer surgeries need to be done quickly and which ones maybe don't. And these were some really early ones because they hadn't extended outside of the prostate gland.
Right. And so in this particular study, they were looking at long-term survival, and in this they followed them for 8 years. They were looking to see if those cancers were more likely to have gone outside of the prostate for those people who chose to have surgery versus those who decided to wait. And what they really found was that there was no difference in the two groups.
Yeah, less than 1% of the men who had delayed surgery died. And again, that was not different from those who had prompt surgery. So really the conclusion, which I think sounds like both of us probably agree with, is that for those who have early prostate cancer and they wanted to defer it for active surveillance and be monitored with regular blood tests, that may be okay for some period of time for some of these early cancer patients.
Yeah, it's certainly a reasonable thing to be discussing, and unfortunately it's not as common in the United States as it is in many parts of the world.
Well, I think that this will be changing a little bit. And speaking of changing a little bit, this next one's something I think we have to address. But, you know, I wonder how many of our listeners out there, probably more so women than men, but how many listeners are taking some of these common osteoporosis drugs that strengthen your bone, these drugs called bisphosphonates?
Yeah, so we're talking about these bisphosphonates, which help build bone strength and prevent bone fractures or breaks in bones if you have really thin bones. And in this, you've probably heard on the news, there's some information about the potential that these medicines may increase a person's risk of developing cancer of the esophagus.
Yeah, published in the British Medical Journal, very good journal, really looking at the really side effects of these particular drugs. And last time, Christy, I think we spoke about this maybe a year ago, we were a little worried about some of the increasing side effects. These drugs really help strengthen bones in patients who may not be able to get their osteoporosis treated in other ways. But in this particular case, their cancer risk actually almost doubled, though we should say it was a low cancer risk.
Right. So this showed that it did over 5 years, for people who took it more than 5 years, double the risk of esophageal cancer. But like you're saying, Adam, the risk of esophageal cancer is so low that to double that risk goes from low to low, but a little bit higher.
Right. And it made me also think, though, you know, if you're going to have a serious discussion about, an honest discussion with your physician about starting these drugs for osteoporosis, you should also know what is your absolute benefit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need to know the number needed to treat. How many people would you have to treat to actually benefit one to prevent, let's say, a hip fracture? And how many people would you need to treat to actually cause one case of esophageal cancer? This is, I think, a much more detailed discussion that we need to encourage our patients and our colleagues to have about the treatment with these drugs.
Well, and in this case, this is one study, and so further study for sure needs to be done.
Well, let's talk about something a little bit different now, Christy.
We're
something
talk
that
about
is
urination.
Going to affect all of us and does affect urination. That's going to the bathroom in simple terms.
Yep.
At night, getting up at night to go to the bathroom. And I'm not going to ask you if it happens to you, and I won't tell you if it happens to me, but it happens to a lot of people.
It sure does. So this was a study looking at lifestyle changes or some simple tips that you could tell a patient and to see if those things make a difference in the amount of time that, or the number of times that someone has to wake up in the night to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I have so many patients who say, you know, well, I usually drink, you know, a full 16-ounce glass of water before I go to bed. I said, well, yeah, is it any wonder that you're up at night peeing? And so don't do that. But they're talking about some other things here in addition to maybe not drinking so much after dinner.
So they looked at 56 people who complained of nighttime waking to go to the bathroom, who were about 75 years of age, and they tested the effects of these four different lifestyle recommendations. So restricting the fluids to about 2% of a person's body weight during the day.
Limiting how much time you spend in the bed itself.
Mm-hmm. To have some moderate daily exercise.
And to keep warm while sleeping, which I kind of like.
And they followed these people for about 4 weeks and found that for these participants, the average number of nighttime bathroom trips dropped significantly.
Now, there was no control population, so this could have just been a strong placebo. But it sounds like something's real here. Which of those four things helped, we don't know. But there was no side effects.
That's right. And most of the medications that are used to help people with this have tons of side effects, so much that up to 70% of patients stop using the different medicines within 6 months because of that. So these things don't really have very many side effects. So there's a lot of potential, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think I understand the mechanism fully, particularly that keeping warm in bed, but I can see some things. And certainly this could improve the quality of sleep, which is actually something that we all care tremendously about and probably cut down on falls from people having to get up so frequently. Good thing. What's our very last research that matters, Christy?
Okay, this is about concussions in kids and ER visits. So let's talk about
that
what
a lot,
are we saying.
Doesn't it?
Well, we're talking about concussions, but let's define what we're talking about.
Well, the trauma from when you get hit frequently in sports for these kids, but it could be any type of major head trauma, and they have a momentary loss of the way they are oriented and maybe have some dizziness. So it happens over 100,000 kids a year.
Yeah, really, really actually very common. So this was a study done in the Journal of Pediatrics, taking a pulse of how many of these injuries happen that show up to the emergency room every year. And in the United States, this translated to about 144,000 pediatric concussions each year.
And I guess the thing that was surprising here was that almost a quarter, a little more than a quarter, 28%, left the emergency room apparently without being told to have follow-up instructions with their family doctor and their pediatrician. And, you know, I'm not so certain that they weren't told that, but there wasn't documentation they were told that.
Right. And it is a good idea to have follow-up with the doctor so that that primary doctor can find out a little bit more about the symptoms, how long did it last after the emergency department. In the emergency room, they sort of rule out an emergent badness, but then you need follow-up to have further counseling and evaluation.
Because the dizziness, you might have dizziness that lasts for a week or two, subtle memory things, your ability to learn in the classroom, a lot of things that, you know, you could prepare the family for. So I do think the follow-up is a good thing. And if it's not happening all the time, it should be.
And to find out when your child can go back to sports.
Well, so, that probably concludes, Christy, but we've really hit on some interesting issues and research that matters today.
We have. We talked about concussions. We talked about trying to reduce nighttime bathroom trips.
And some really worrisome drugs that potentially, if they could increase cancer risk, you might have to have that conversation about osteoporosis drugs. But then the good thing about maybe can delay early prostate cancer surgery if you need to.
That's right. So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We are going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Darren DeWalt about health literacy and doctor-patient communication. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about health literacy and doctor-patient communication. And in simple terms, it's what do you hear when you go to your doctor, from your doctor? Do you remember it? And what can we do to make that better, so to make your health better?
And so we'd like to welcome Dr. Darren DeWall to talk with us about this. He is an associate professor at the UNC School of Medicine. He is a practicing general internist, and he studies the relationship between health literacy and health outcomes, as well as strategies to improve health for people who have low health literacy. He attended medical school at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee and received his Master of Public Health degree here at UNC. And we're glad to have you with us today, Dr. DeWall.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Dr. DeWall, you know, before we get into asking maybe to help us define this term low health literacy, which I don't think is an intuitive term for a lot of people, even physicians, tell us a little bit, how did you get interested in this area of research, which is really critically important for patients and doctors?
Well, thanks for asking that question. I find this area very interesting to do research. And the reason I got into it is I was troubled that people could come to the doctor, and I experienced this as a resident. People would come to the doctor and leave and not really understand what happened. And I remember when I was an intern taking care of young mothers in a pediatrics internship, and I explained something to the young mom, and she looked at me and she said, "I have no idea what you just said to me." And I was really impressed that she had the courage to tell me that, but that experience always stuck with me, and I wondered, how can we do a better job communicating with our patients?
And so medical care is so complicated. It's increasingly complicated as we move forward with time and technology. And we're talking about understand all the things a patient needs to understand, how to make the appointment, medications, how to understand what the doctor's telling you to do. Is all of this part of health literacy, or define it for us?
Absolutely, Christy. I think all of that is part of health literacy. And the way I think of health literacy, and you're right, it is a little bit it's not intuitive what it means. But if you can think of anything that you have to do as a patient to make your health better, anything that you're struggling with is requiring your health literacy skills. So from making an appointment to following the instructions that you might get either from your doctor or from the pharmacist or anyone that's helping take care of you, to dealing with your insurance company and understanding the bills that you receive. There are several tasks that we're asked to do as patients, and many of those tasks are becoming more and more complicated each and every week or every month as more advances and more complicated treatments become available.
You know, I love when I first went to your website to understand a little bit more about the program, it had me just immediately go to this health literacy video, the 6-minute video that was made by one of the leading physician organizations in the country to kind of, I guess, really draw you right in there. And the examples were wonderful ones that are all too common to Christy and I and any physician of, you know, a patient on 22 medications and trying to figure out how many of them do this versus that and side effects and to remember them to the serious diseases we tell them about, to the simple things like I sent a patient today, their lab results. Do I really understand that what they're getting when they look at that? How did you decide as a starting place to show someone, the doctor, what's happening? Is it like to almost shock us?
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And what we found, the video has been an incredibly powerful tool in teaching people about health literacy because on the video, as you pointed out, Adam, there are people trying to deal with everyday medical tasks and showing how easy it is to get confused. And these are the people that are my patients. They're my family members. They're not special. They're just everyday people who struggle with health care. The reason we show the video is exactly to get the reaction that we got from you for exactly that reason. And we found in testing this toolkit for practices, when we would interact with the staff of the practices after they showed the video, they said that changed the way I saw my job. And it totally...
What do you mean by that?
All of a sudden, we realized how much we're communicating day in and day out that people are struggling with. And I believe, and I think why the video is so powerful is these are common everyday situations that we as clinicians often assume people understand. And it's because we deal with it day in and day out. And it's normal for us. But for most people in our communities and in our society, these medical interactions are not their everyday normal stuff.
Well, let's talk about these assumptions. So, I mean, the most basic one that comes to mind with health literacy is just literacy. So I think, you know, we assume that people can read. And I'm remembering this off the top of my head, but I think it's like one in five Americans reads at a fifth grade level or less. It may be more impressive than that. But a lot of people aren't able to read really complicated things, but yet we hand them patient education materials to go and read about this illness, or we write out a complicated prescription that they may not understand what it's for. But what are the other assumptions? So we assume people can read.
We assume they can read. And actually, let me come back to that point because that's very important. Most of our patients can read. And you, like you pointed out, maybe 20 or 25% have literacy skills that are fairly low by some standards, but most of them can still read.
Right.
And it's actually not a common problem in the United States for people to be completely illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
We all have patients, and there are people that never learn to read well, but most people can read some. And the problem is usually, like you pointed out, we're asking them to do tasks or read materials that far exceed their capacity to read and understand without making errors. So that's one assumption that we make all of the time. When one thing that I've observed a lot in clinical care, and I observe this of myself as a clinician, is I'm having an interaction with a patient, a lot of words are exchanged. And at least in my mind, there are certain things that I expect that patient to remember, but quite frequently the patient has no idea that I wanted them to remember that.
Can you give me an example of something? Because the first thing that comes to mind is like, you know, I say, I want you to take this medicine three times a day. And I assume that means, you know, that they would know somehow from up on the mountain on high that they should take it at 8 a.m., 12 p.m., and 6 p.m. with their meals. But I don't say that.
Right, right. So medication instructions are fraught with lots of errors, and we do that all of the time. The most frequent example that I have is when I'm in the room with a patient, I may cover their high blood pressure, and we may talk about that, and I'll say, well, I want you to go ahead and take two of those pills each day, and you can take them at the same time, and I'll try and teach them exactly. But then I'll move on and start talking about diabetes or their back pain or other common problems that people are facing, but I never come back to those instructions about the high blood pressure pills. Well, unless somebody was taking notes, and not all patients and not all doctors do, by the time they're walking out of the visit, there's no recollection that I had said double your blood pressure medicine.
And there's some data to support this, right? What is it, 50% of what we doctors think they tell patients don't remember? Or what's the statistic?
That's right. If you ask people when they walk out of the visit with us as primary care doctors how much they remember, somewhere less than half of what we thought they should remember, they actually do remember. And even that which they remember, often it's not exactly accurate with what we wanted them to.
So there's this whole issue then of what's occurring between the patient and the doctor. And you've already indicated that it's much bigger than that because it's every interaction with a healthcare encounter. But I think for the purpose of the show today, if we just focused on that, because that there's so many issues in there that we can improve. You could work on the patient level, right, to increase their ability to ask good questions, to say,
yes,
I don't understand, or you could work with the doctors in the practice. It seems like with what your work you're doing now, you're working with the doctor in the practice. Why that choice?
Excellent question. Great framing. You can work on both directions, and I think we all do work in both directions. For this particular body of work, we're focusing on the clinician. What we know is that a lot of the information we provide is more complicated than it needs to be. And it's really difficult to go out and change the skills of an entire population so that everyone starts understanding all of this complicated material. It's actually a bit easier to teach clinicians, whether it's doctors, nurses, physical therapists, the pharmacist, whoever it may be, to think about how to communicate things in the easiest and most understandable way. We think that that has to be done. We also, most of us in this area of research, also believe we can improve skills of patients and help them become more health literate. But there's always, how do I put this? For health literacy, there are always two sides. There's the skills of the patient and the complexity of the task at hand. And we need to improve the skills and lower complexity.
Well, I know we're going to need to take a short break, but I'm sure when we come back, we're going to really want to really understand how are you doing this and what kind of outcomes are you finding and the challenges of the work. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back talking with our guest, Dr. Darren DeWalt.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been talking with Dr. Darren DeWalt from UNC about health literacy and doctor-patient communication. And Dr. DeWalt, we've talked a little bit about what is health literacy and how complex medical care is, and your work with really targeting towards physicians to teach us how we can do a better job really communicating effectively to patients so that they can walk away from our encounter understanding the best way to take care of their health. And so we wondered if we could go ahead and transition a little bit into that, into some of the tips that you're working on to help us do a better job.
Very good. Yes, we've got some good tips in our toolkit.
So there.
Tell us about one of them. This is the thing you call this brown bag medication review. And I like the name, and I like better what I think it implies. What's that about?
Well, this was one of the most popular tools when we tested the toolkit with primary care practices. And what this tool implies, it's a brown bag review of medications. It's exactly what it says. The patient brings into the clinic visit in a brown bag, or any bag for that matter, all of their medications, and someone in the practice, the nurse or the doctor, goes over those medications to confirm that what the patient is taking at home is the same as what we think they should be taking based on the record or our medical opinion.
And the research would say that those are often different. What the patient's actually taking and what the doctor thinks the patient's taking is not always the same.
That's exactly what the research shows. And what we found in practices that would do this, when we talk about implementing new strategies like this, we always have a practice do a small test. So we would have these practices take 5 or 10 patients and say, try this out and see what you find. The practices would call us back and say, we did this with 10 patients and 5 of them had something that they were taking or not taking that was different from what we thought. And each practice that did this would find at least one case where it was kind of important, like the patient was taking the same pill from 2 different bottles. So they were taking 2 different thyroid medicines at the same time. And so it gets to be quite dangerous.
Yeah, I had a patient not too long ago who was taking 2 of the same type of antihypertensive called ACE inhibitors that can really affect the kidney. And they were taking 2 different ones because they had different names given by 2 different doctors. And I was like, this light bulb went off. And I bet that's probably what it feels like to doctors everywhere when they start doing this. Mm-hmm. When you find something like this, the light bulb goes off like, oh, my goodness.
That's absolutely right, Adam. And that's one of the reasons we put this tool on our Quick Start Guide, because like the video, this was a tool that helps the light go off saying there's a problem that I've got to be thinking about when I'm taking care of patients to make sure that we're concordant, that we are that the doctor has a plan in place that's talked about with the patient. The patient understands is able to implement the plan that's best for that patient's life.
And are you recommending that doctors have these brown bag visits every single visit with a patient, that they always bring their medicines, or that they have a special type of visit once every so often?
Well, what we recommend is that a patient should have a review at least once a year. Mm-hmm. But also anytime changes could be made if the patient was in the hospital. Certainly any time you're in the hospital, your next visit, bring all of your medicines. That's a big time for medicines to get mixed up. Mm-hmm. if things are never changed, if they're on a stable regimen, then once every year is probably reasonable for that.
And what other tips do you recommend to doctors? There's some on communication tips that we can do better?
Well, we have a few key tips for doctors. One is tips for communicating clearly. And this is just basic advice.
Oh, wait a sec. You mean not all doctors don't communicate clearly? Oh, my goodness. Another light bulb.
Right.
Lots of medical terms.
Most of us think we're God's gift to communication. It turns out we're not.
Oh, and, so
but
sad.
Thinking about the words that we choose, already in this conversation with you guys, I found myself using pieces of jargon that, like, regimen. What's a regimen? And we need to learn to get rid of that language, or at least explain that language for the patient.
And what about asking the patient to do they understand what you just said? Do you ever recommend that you do a pause if you're trying to talk about something complicated just to see if there's understanding what it is you're saying?
Absolutely. And that's getting close to something we call the teach back.
What's that?
Where we ask the patient to tell us back what their plan is when they get home, or if they can articulate or talk about what I was just explaining. Articulate, right? Not a good word. If the patient could tell me back what it is that we're talking about so I can be sure that the patient understands me. Now,
can you give an example of where that goes off? Because I think I know what you mean. I know I've told the patient eight things, and then when they get home, maybe some of those just fall in the trash can for reasons. Is that?
That's exactly what happens. And what I've gotten in the habit of doing with my own patients is toward the end of the visit, I'll say, okay, now tell me what you're going to do when you get home. What was our plan? And then I want the patient to be able to tell back to me, well, you told me that this medicine I should stop taking and this other medicine I should start taking two pills each morning, and I can't remember the third thing you wanted me to do.
Hmm. And that's the opportunity.
That's the opportunity. Also, I can correct if I didn't communicate clearly and they got something wrong earlier, that gives me the chance to clarify and make sure that the patient knows.
What about writing things down? Because we really encourage our resident doctors, and I try to do this myself, especially if you're making more than one change, to really write down in very plain language what medicine you're going to stop. And don't use words like discontinue on there, but put stop this one and write it out very clearly. Is that effective for improving this or not?
Yes, that's a really important thing to do, and we all need to do that more. Patients can write down too.
Mm-hmm.
I encourage my patients to bring notebooks to the doctor's office, but I frequently employ that practice to write down what we talked about. Stop this, start this, very plain language, and then I do one at last thing is I'll hand them the paper and say, can you read my writing?
Mm.
And I'll have them take a look at it and tell me what they're going to do. So I use that as part of the teach back because, you know, doctors are notorious for having poor handwriting.
Yes.
And so that diffuses the situation. If they look at it and say, yeah, it's fine, then usually I'll have them do the teach back verbally because it may be that they didn't want to admit that my writing was too complicated for them to understand.
We're talking with Dr. Darren DeWalt of the UNC School of Medicine, and we're going to have to wrap up in just a minute. But I wonder, you know, we focus this conversation today on really what providers can do to really increase the comfort level of what's understood and done in the medical practice. But there's some things that patients could probably do, too, to help us. How do you that conversation to help empower our listeners, who are all patients, and Christy and I, who are patients, to have better encounters using these same tools and techniques?
That's right. There's a lot that we can do as patients to improve communication with our doctor. One thing is to come in with a plan and a list to make sure that your questions get answered. That really helps the doctor. Some of my patients are a little bit shy when they bring out their list, and I have to say, no, this is great. I want you to do this every time.
Mm-hmm.
But having a list and having a plan. The second is do the teach back on your own. So if I'm seeing you in clinic, Christy, and you give me some instructions, I might say, now let me just make sure that I have this right. This is what you want me to do. And then it doesn't matter whether the doctor remembers to do the teach back. You've done it on your own.
Right.
That's probably the most effective strategy to make sure that you and your doctor have come to some agreement on the plan. It's real important to ask the doctor questions. Some of us as physicians don't give off good vibes about asking us questions. We're trying to leave the room. We're busy. We're standing up, trying to get out of there. But just coming in with your list makes your questions clear right up front. And taking the time to clarify actually is going to save your doctor time later, because if there's not clarity, something might go wrong. And you may need to call your doctor later. So just take the time and say, just a second, let me just make sure I understand you.
Well, this is such important work, Dr. DeWalt, and we thank you for being our guest today. What is the website or resource for patients?
Well, the website is www.nchealthliteracy.org.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. DeWalt, for your work and for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks. It's vitally important for patients, doctors, and all of us who are both patients and seekers of health care.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions, experiences, and your attitudes towards medical care.
And you can write us, and we will answer them. A lot of people write us. They call us. They let us know. They pull us in the hallways, and we're going to address them. But if you want, you can send them at yourhealth@unc.edu. Call us at 966-8081, and we'll ask our executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our very first house call. Julie.
Dear Drs. Goldstein and Page, I went to a campfire party the other night, and I'm pretty sure I got chiggers. That night, I put bug spray on my arms, but I forgot my legs. I was a little itchy that night, but over the following day or two, I became incredibly itchy all over, especially on my legs. There are little bumps all over my legs, and all I can think about is scratching. I tried a Veno bath and calamine lotion, but I'm not getting any relief. What do you recommend for chigger bites?
Oh, wow, that made me itch a little bit hearing your story.
Yeah, and I kind of like say, want to say, you dummy, put that bug spray on your legs. How could you forget? It's like the person forgets sunscreen, you know, everywhere except their neck, and then they get a burn on their neck. You know? But it happens to all of us. We all forget.
It does. So the good news is that it will go away, that your body will sort of fight it off, and any treatment that we have is really just aimed to decrease the itching so that you can survive until it goes away.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I've probably mentioned this remedy before, but, you know, ice is a really good effective cold compresses because the water can evaporate and it's cooling and cools down the itching. And then, you know, the over-the-counter stuff that you've been using is good, but sometimes I say, do you have anything really strong prescription steroid cream?
Right. So steroid creams can make a difference for sure, as well as antihistamines. And now a lot of those, I mean, Benadryl's the cheapest one, but it makes you sleepy. But those medicines like Zyrtec or Claritin and those things you can get over-the-counter can help you a little bit as well.
And if it's really bad, talk to your doctor. They may or may not even give you a prescription for prednisone. Kind of the big gun, but it works quickly. It's pretty cheap and not too many side effects.
I would argue with you on that one.
About the side effects?
About the side effects. It can make you kind of loopy. But
okay, well, we'll
good
see.
Good luck. Hope you feel better soon.
What's next, Julie?
Lots of my relatives have had kidney stones, and I want to avoid getting them as much as possible. Is it true that drinking lots of fluids helps avoid them? How much should I drink every day?
You know, those are great, great questions. And I don't, you know, when I first heard this question, Christy, I thought, I should know these things, but I'm not sure I actually knew them, so I had to look some of this up too.
Well, and we tell people to drink lots of fluids when you have a kidney stone to help sort of flush out your system, but this is more about prevention, which is a little bit different.
Yeah, you know, there's some interesting research that, you know, shows that people who had their first kidney stone did drink less than people who didn't have kidney stones. And in a big survey of over 200,000 men and women, there was a 30% lower risk of developing a kidney stone in those who had the highest level fluid intake. So that and this emerging research suggests that, you know, drinking more liquid, particularly down here in the South when it's so hot, frequently can be beneficial to prevent those kidney stones.
Sure. So the most important dietary things you can do to try to reduce your risk of stones, for calcium stones in particular, are to drink more fluids, and we're talking like at least 10 glasses of fluids a day, to restrict salt or sodium in the diet, and to reduce your protein intake. But I would talk with your doctor or a nutritionist a little bit more about how to do that effectively.
Yeah, a lot of times people, for instance, when they travel, particularly on airplanes, don't realize that their fluid intake mm-hmm. goes up just like exercise. And so there are times which you actually have to increase your fluid intake and to try to have the urine be more alkaline to help prevent the kidney stones. So soda drinking is actually not as good as water. So not all fluid is equal.
That's true. That's true. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of information. Julie, what do we have next?
Help. I've heard so much recently about bed bugs that I'm starting to dream about them. When I go to a hotel, should I ask if they've had any problems with them before making a reservation?
Well, if you're starting to dream about them, then we probably need to see you down yeah. in our office, and we might have to intervene with some medications there. Well, but you're reading about them everywhere.
I know. There's so much about it on the news, and they're just gross to think about. And so I feel for you. But hopefully we can talk a little bit about what they are and try to relieve some of your fears.
Yeah. I mean, bed bugs are, you know, one of this type of organism that does feed on people, and it tends to go to sites where people sleep. They don't usually go on surface of beds or chairs, but they go in the kind of the cracks of where things are and kind of reside in the cracks of where beds are.
And they do often feed on a person when the person's sleeping, and usually that's done just before in the early morning, just before dawn. And sometimes people will see little tracks on their skin where the bed bugs have bitten them.
Yeah, you used to see this only in the refugee camps where people were together and the bugs were staying in these thatch roofs and in the beds. But now they are in lots of hotel rooms, and they do typically bite at night on the exposed area of the skin. And so you can find them on your face, neck, hands, and arms when you awaken, or maybe a day or two later. They're usually kind of a series of bites, kind of one in a row. And so they kind of are referred to as breakfast, lunch, and dinner, three bites that kind of occur kind of in a row, which is different than lots of mosquito bites and kind of be at random.
So to answer your question of should you call and ask a hotel beforehand if they've had any trouble with it, I mean, yeah, if you're worried about it and
absolutely.
You want to know how safe your environment is, sure, ask about it. I don't think that it's it's never wrong to ask that question. I don't know whether you're going to get an honest answer and whether or not that's going to make a real difference. But if it makes you feel better about it, for sure that's worth it.
Well, and, you know, worrying about bed bugs and or a place that has it would disrupt your sleep, and people may avoid you in your house. I mean, there's all kinds of psychological and social manifestations of how this could be there. And certainly the itching alone, which even though the bites are painless, the itching is profound. So having this can be very, very stressful. You can get anxious. You can get depressed. Avoiding it, we're all in favor of that.
Okay, Julie, what's our last house call?
I'm in my 40s and really healthy, but I've recently started experiencing ringing in my ears. When it starts, I usually feel very disoriented, and sometimes I break out into a sweat and feel like I might throw up. It usually just lasts for a few minutes, and then I feel completely fine. What does this sound like to you?
That sounds like vertigo.
Or ringing in the ears, or with dizziness.
Exactly.
With dizziness and nausea. This is like there's a whole host of things, but vertigo is what doctors will tell patients.
Yeah, vertigo is that type of dizziness where the room is spinning, and sometimes you can get nausea with it. Sometimes it can be associated with ringing in the ears and can make you feel nauseous and feel awful, and it's scary when it happens.
And, you know, some people just get the ringing in the ears, and we call that just simple tinnitus or ringing in the ears. Well, we have a fancy medical name to everything, Christy. But the vertigo is that more severe form, and the problem is even though most of the times it's really a very simple thing like a virus, at times there can be many more serious types of causes of that. So frequently people do come to the doctor.
Yeah, it's worth coming to the doctor at least so that we can try to tease out, is there anything else going on or anything worrisome that could be causing the symptoms? But a lot of times we can say, oh, this is what we call benign positional vertigo, or
it kind of gets that when you change positions, it gets worse and better depending on which position you're in.
Can be from inflammation of your inner ear. Or it could be other things like something called Meniere's disease.
Van Gogh's disease. Pulled that ear off because thinking that was going to solve it, but this combination of really severe vertigo, ringing, and hearing loss.
And there are several other things that could cause it too. So it's worth a visit to get it checked out. And there are some medicines that can at least diminish the symptoms a little bit.
Well, Christy, I think that probably does what we can do for house calls today. But we've had a really good chance to talk about, I think, some really common things and that people can do something with, like vertigo.
Tiggers and bed bugs.
How much fluid, 10 glasses of water a day to help maybe prevent kidney stones.
And hopefully those things were helpful to you. We thank you for writing us and for joining us today for Your Health. And we hope we've addressed some issues that are important to you and your health. We want you to write us at yourhealth@unc.edu, call us at 966-8081, or follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter.
Lots of ways to get in touch with us.
Lots of ways.
And we should thank people today. WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Darren DeWalt. Hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
And on behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.